Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Coming up on the show, many lawmakers continue to tweak Wyoming's gun laws.
Yeah, I'm pretty much with being able to carry a gun anywhere.
A group of friends in Guernsey trying to solve the affordable housing problem themselves.
We're going to use our money to try and at least make a little bit of a difference.
And the community of Laramie is coming together to make the mountainside on the outskirts of town a park.
I don't think we've ever seen that diverse group of people come together to try to make a project succeed.
Those stories and more are all coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. This year, the Wyoming legislature is dealing with a couple of pro-gun bills. So what else is new? It seems like lawmakers are discussing gun bills all the time. But supporters of the legislation say that's because there are still self-defense and safety issues that need to be resolved. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck reports.
This year, lawmakers have generated headlines as they've tried to give gun owners more of an opportunity to defend themselves in public with Stand Your Ground legislation. The concern is that the courts have sometimes blamed gun owners for not using restraint in situations where someone believed their life was in danger. The other bill allows guns in churches. The sponsor of that bill is Representative Bunky Laux of Casper, who says he was driven by recent shootings at churches.
I mean, there's going to be more and more of these type of things happen. There's a lot of sick people out there. I mean, you know, the guy that's going to go commit a mass murder in a unhardened place, as we now call the term, they're not going to go to the biker bar or the police department. They're going to kill people that can't defend themselves, and they know they can't. It just isn't working.
Lawmakers did pass a bill last year that let school boards decide if trained teachers should be allowed to have guns in schools, measures to allow guns on college campuses and in government meetings were either voted down or vetoed. In recent years, Wyoming passed a law that allowed people to carry concealed weapons without a permit. House Majority Leader David Miller says public shootings across the country have influenced the actions of the bill sponsors.
I think it does, absolutely. You know, the pressures from these events that occur, the one recently in Florida, puts pressure on doing more here.
Down the hall in the Senate sits former gun lobbyist and freshman Senator Anthony Bouchard. Bouchard has worked hard to get gun legislation passed, and sometimes he's been very aggressive. He says that's because things are getting serious in the country. While some see the solution as fewer guns, Bouchard says the solution is being able to protect yourself. He is adamant that gun-free areas like schools and the Wyoming legislature are dangerous.
The right that you have to defend yourself shouldn't end just when you cross over into another piece of property, especially when it's government property.
Yeah, I'm pretty much with being able to carry a gun anywhere.
That's Lander Senator Cale Case. He's a Republican, but most view him as a strong libertarian. Case has fought hard for gun legislation over the years, but he adds that he wants responsible gun legislation.
I have trouble really thinking about a place where a gun shouldn't be. On the other hand, I think if somebody uses a gun, they have to be responsible for it. And the having the gun, you can't have immunity in my mind about what might happen. It has to meet this reasonable test. And I think that's balance on both sides.
Case was referencing efforts by Stand Your Ground advocates to give blanket immunity from prosecution in situations where someone believed their life was in danger. But that aside, Case says Second Amendment rights are about protecting yourself. He says it can be dangerous sometimes, but smiles and says so can the First Amendment. But one thing he's very serious about is his belief that guns in public places will limit some of the high-profile shootings in recent years.
I honestly don't think that we can provide enough school resources, resource officers or metal detectors or keyway systems into all schools and other public places that we can protect. And I know that this is where people are deeply on the other side. I don't know how we're going to work that one out.
Bouchard also understands that there are those that believe that gun rights advocates have lost their minds and are making things more unsafe. But he says, despite concerns by law enforcement, concealed carry without a permit has had very little negative impact in the state. He thinks anti-gun laws have actually done more damage.
It seems that when we look at areas that have limited guns, used gun control, it doesn't look like they're safer there. It puts an imbalance to where the citizens don't have the ability to protect themselves.
Bouchard says as long as the federal government brings up the topic of enhanced gun laws, it encourages states like Wyoming to pass bills restoring gun rights. But Green River Representative Stan Blake says Wyoming really doesn't need a lot more gun laws. Blake is a Democrat who generally votes for Second Amendment bills, but he doesn't know what kind of good they do. He laughs and says most people in Wyoming are armed, whether they admit it or not.
I think Wyoming gun ownership is like the highest. I would think twice before I would be a criminal coming to Wyoming because you might have a big surprise when they open the door.
Blake says national groups will continue to bring new gun legislation because it's what they do. House Majority Leader David Miller adds that those groups have found that gun bills are helpful when it comes to elections.
You know, there's people trying to make points one way or the other. With all these bills, you know the game better than most, you know, and, you know, they get recorded votes and all this, and they use it in campaigns.
Miller says to expect another slew of gun bills next year. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
When school shootings occur, the country collectively asks, what needs to happen to keep students safe? What does it take to identify students who are struggling and get them support? Wyoming Public Radio's education reporter Tennessee Watson sat down with University of Wyoming Professor of Counseling Mary Alice Bruce and graduate student Ken Hilton to talk about how school counselors fit into the conversation about safe schools.
Well, I think we're really integral. I think frequently anybody in a school will notice the students that are doing really well or that are struggling to a significant degree. But school counselors have an opportunity to have a more in-depth relationship with the wide variety of students. So they have a role in noticing, you know, your middle-of-the-pack students that might have a little bit more going on than than might be seen on the surface, I guess.
And school counselors are part of that school team. So we work so closely with the administrators, the teachers, the paras, the parents and community. We kind of bring that system together, and we know what's going on. We're the glue that holds the school together and helps support a safe climate in the school.
And NPR has done some reporting on school counselor shortages nationwide, resulting in counselors carrying large caseloads and putting schedules together and putting out fires, but really not being able to do the work that they're trained to do. And so what does it look like when there are adequate counseling resources in schools, and what do we know is possible?
A lot is possible because our counselors earn 61 credit hours for their master's degree. Our school counselors are also able to be licensed as mental health counselors, and so they're prepared to take on roles and responsibilities that really help the academic and career and psychosocial development of our kids. Ken, I know you're in the schools right now doing a lot of prevention activities.
For me, that's a really important role for when a school counseling program is running well, when we have enough power, like enough people, is the role of providing some instruction for the social-emotional development of our students. I think typically, especially in Wyoming, we do a really great job of providing a solid academic base for our students. And it's the school counselor's role in a well-staffed program to come in and kind of round out that holistic education for our students so we are working on prevention. You know, we've seen time and time again that prevention is far more effective than, crisis response.
So, for instance, some years ago in Natrona County, Some of the administrators and school counselors got together and wrote a federal grant wherein they hired prepared elementary school counselors in about half of the elementary schools. And the programs were well-run and comprehensive. What did they see? Huge increases in the math test scores, in the English test scores, in the reading test scores of those elementary schools where they had elementary school counselors. They have repeated this experiment several times, replicated it in other places in the United States, and they've always seen that huge increase in the test scores. And so we know that kiddos are able to learn when they feel good about themselves. They have their brain clicking, the blood's in the frontal lobes where they're doing decision-making and learning and not stuck in the amygdala where they're worried emotionally. So we can really create safety, safe climate, and learning communities in the schools when we have elementary and middle and high school counselors.
So if you're telling me, you know, the data says this is a good idea, what's behind the shortage nationally? What are the barriers to making sure that all kids have the support that they need?
Well, personally, I think that not all school districts realize the benefits of having school counselors at all levels and people prepared to really do the service delivery in the classrooms and in small groups in addition to individual counseling. So sometimes the priority is not there and they don't quite realize how the academic success and career readiness can be enhanced greatly, significantly, with school counselors.
Yeah, and I agree. I think that we're kind of in a place now where we need to be promoting the wide range of what a school counselor can do, and it's not always clear if a program hasn't experienced that yet, that there is more than just working with a student one-on-one, and that becoming a part of the school community and working in the classrooms, and even things like supporting the teachers when they're doing a lot of the really heavy lifting in a school are things that a school counselor can bring. And it's not always as well known that that's what we do.
And what's the landscape like for school counseling in Wyoming?
Well, it's really positive. We were thrilled when the legislature a couple years ago, as a line item, added to renew our counseling program in Casper. So not only are we preparing school counselors here in Laramie, we are also in Casper with intensive weekend programs to prepare our school counselors.
And Ken, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're raised in Wyoming, you're studying counseling in Wyoming, you want to work in Wyoming. What's your take on school counseling in the state right now?
You're correct in all those things, and I think it's necessary. We need more of it, and I think the administrators around the state are coming to see that. And you know, I'm excited as I kind of launch into my career. I think we're in a good place, and you see the people that I'm working with in schools right now, my classmates at UW here. People want to give back to the communities they're from and be a part. You know, people live in Wyoming for a reason, and a lot of them want to stay here and continue developing this community that we care about.
Well, it's great to hear about these things happening in Wyoming. Dr. Mary Alice Bruce is professor of counseling at the University of Wyoming, and Ken Hilton is a graduate student in counseling as well as the Wyoming School Counselor Association's graduate student representative. Thank you so much for sharing your insights.
Thank you, Tennessee.
Yeah, it was great to come down.
Later in the program, a story on efforts to open up land outside Laramie to the public. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. Last year, Governor Matt Mead assembled a task force to figure out how Wyoming's bountiful outdoor recreation could boost the state's economy. One way the group identified was to create more access to open space right on the outskirts of towns so local businesses could benefit. As Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports, now the community of Laramie is working to do just that.
5 minutes from downtown Laramie, Melanie Arnett unlocks a gate. She pulls the truck through, and we're inside the 5,500-acre parcel of land that Laramie folks have been drooling to explore for years. I'm feeling pretty smug about my VIP pass.
Right now, we're looking right at Pilot Peak. We're facing it. You see Jackrabbit Canyon. That extends all the way down right here.
Arnett was recently hired to serve as the Pilot Hill Land Project's director. A local businessman volunteered to pay her salary for now. For the last few months, she's been working hard to bring together the city, the county, businesses, nonprofits to raise the $10.5 million the landowner is asking for this property. And she's making some serious headway. The Wyoming Community Foundation recently set up a fund and is already taking donations. And last fall, Albany County signed a purchase agreement for the land. Now it's just a matter of actually getting the money. But at the moment, Arnett's job is four-wheeling. It's not long before we encounter a herd of pronghorn.
This is crucial winter antelope range. I think this herd particularly lives right here.
And so does a lot of other wildlife. Hawks, elk, bear, moose. And when we get to the top and start walking through the aspens, we even find mountain lion tracks.
Yeah, here's something interesting.
Blood!
Really?
Oh my God!
Blood in this track,
oh,
too.
Yeah.
There.
Oh my gosh.
Wonder what's going on.
Awesome. I think this is a cat kill.
Yeah, I think you're right.
It's fresh signs of mountain lion activity that show this is a healthy landscape, the kind people like to hike, bike, hunt, or teach kids about. Arnett says making such places available means the people who live near them are healthier too, and so are their economies. Arnett says it's easier for businesses to recruit employees when they can show off how close public lands are. And Laramie could host major events. She's already had interest in an organizer from the Interscholastic Cycling Association to host mountain bike races up here. He told her one race could inject as much as $200,000 into the community because 450 racers and their families would come.
Look at what we're looking at right now. We've got some giant ponderosas around us and rolling terrain that provides everything you would need for a mountain bike race. And those kids would come here, travel back home and say, I want to go ride there again.
It's still unclear just who would manage this land, the county, a water district. Arnett would love to see it become a state park with world-class mountain bike trails, like in nearby Kurt Gowdy. But as we drive on, Arnett says the community needs to buy this land for more than just the economic benefits.
Right now we're crossing the aquifer. We have the aquifer basically in action right now as the snow melts down into these fractures of the limestone.
This property sits on top of 13% of the Casper Aquifer, the county's main water supply. Laramie folks have long battled over how to properly protect this aquifer. Sarah Gorin is a member of the Albany County Clean Water Advocates. She says some people think an aquifer is an underground lake, but it's not. It's porous rock. Like a sponge, the limestone soaks up melted snow, but it will also soak up other things.
You know, the aquifer is big, and it can take a certain amount of inputs without adverse effects. But if that whole area were to be developed on septic, just human impact, you know, herbicides, pesticides, road runoff, all the kind of things that go along with our daily life, it wouldn't be good.
Landowner Doug Samuelson says if the community can't raise the $10.5 million, the property is already laid out for development of 35-acre ranchettes. Raising so much money to create a park is unprecedented in Wyoming. Wyoming State Parks Administrator Dominic Bravo says Douglas did something on a smaller scale for a historic site.
But I will say I've really never seen a community that for the amount of funds that need to be raised and even the application that we received, well, it was really robust and pretty amazing. So we're pretty excited about where we can go with it.
Bravo admits there's a lot of questions to answer before the east flank of the Laramie Range turns into a state park. Already, people are quibbling over whether to allow motorized trails or dogs off-leash. But a survey shows that for the most part, people want this land. 92% of the county's residents voted for it. But he says all those details can be figured out later because the benefits are so impressive.
Because, I mean, this is a pretty substantial deal when you connect. It almost is basically connecting Cheyenne to Laramie when you think about it.
Mountain bikers could ride from Laramie city limits over the mountain to Kurt Gowdy State Park, 30 miles away. Laramie Senator Chris Rothfuss sits on the county's Funding Oversight Committee. He says this project is a good model for the whole state.
Part of our effort to diversify the economy in Wyoming is really to attract businesses that wouldn't normally locate themselves in Wyoming. When you have this opportunity where we have this world-class recreation available, that's precisely the type of thing that makes Laramie, Wyoming attractive.
But it's going to take some fast footwork. The county has given organizers only until September of this year to raise $10.5 million. Organizers will be unveiling a couple fundraising campaigns in coming weeks. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
Wyoming and most of the western landscape are home to big game migrations. Migratory herds of elk, deer, pronghorn, bison, or bighorn sheep travel routes between their seasonal ranges. Recently, thanks to the research of scientists, it's been found that these corridors contain important stopover habitats where the animals rest and find food. So, if these routes are blocked, it would stop their ability to recover after a winter season. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska asked scientist Arthur Middleton of UC Berkeley whether a new order signed by the Secretary of Interior, Ryan Zinke, will actually help conserve these migration corridors.
The secretarial order from Ryan Zinke does several things, and it's pretty long. It will take time to tell exactly what its full implications are because there are a number of agencies affected, and of course there's a lot of people that have to coordinate to put this into effect. But its main prongs are sort of coordination function. So it says that the Department of Interior and some of the agencies within it will create coordination positions to make sure that there's conversations across multiple agencies where their jurisdictions butt one another along the corridors of migratory populations of elk, deer, and pronghorn. It directs the agencies, and particularly the Bureau of Land Management, to minimize disturbance and development and things like infrastructure development in the sensitive areas used by these animals, particularly in their migration corridors and their seasonal and their winter ranges. And so those are two of the most important functions. It's also very explicit that the agencies work collaboratively with states and with private landowners to implement those actions.
Why are some environmental groups dismissing the order?
Well, there's been some groups that have been dismissive of the order just because there's a sense that, you know, other decisions from the Department of Interior have tended to be towards increasing the pace and scale of development across public lands in the region. And so that this order, which protects certain or increases protection of certain areas used by certain species, is, you know, smaller in scope in terms of its protections than the general tide of increasing development. And so that's where some of the criticism would have been coming from.
So you mentioned earlier the Department of Interior has prioritized energy development. So is this kind of contradicting in the order?
No, I mean, one of the things that the new kind of information that we can gather from these populations is by using GPS collars that get us really detailed information on the movement paths of these animals. We can then really pinpoint the seasonal ranges and the migration routes that are important year after year to any given elk or deer or pronghorn or other ungulate population. And so what those allow is then this kind of potential balancing of, you know, developing some resources and protecting others. So sort of trying to direct some of that development to less sensitive areas.
And has the DOI ever prioritized these migrations before?
The Department of Interior has, I would think it's fair to say, in many regions and kind of local and regional instances, taken care to prioritize, you know, the migration of a particular population. But this is different because it's department level, west-wide order that I think is safe to say for the first time it kind of elevates the migrations to a kind of a higher level of consideration at a larger regional scale.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, a group of friends in Guernsey tries to solve affordable housing. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. What do you get when three ranchers, a school teacher, a real estate agent, and one community development coordinator walk into a bank? In Guernsey, Wyoming, a possible solution to the affordable housing problem that's plaguing the nation. Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen has more.
There's not a single traffic light in Guernsey, Wyoming. Only stop signs and two main roads, U.S. Highway 26 and Wyoming Avenue. Close to where the two main streets intersect is Wyoming West Realty.
You're in the right spot.
That's Doug Frederick. He's not a realtor, but a rancher who's lived here his entire life, along with his brother Chuck.
My great-granddad was a soldier at Old Fort Laramie, homesteaded up Whalen Canyon in 1879, and we're the fifth generation, so we've been here a long time.
Doug says it's a friendly town.
We used to know everybody, but times are changing.
One of those changes, affordable housing in this small town of about 1,100 people. Right now, it costs an average of $250,000 to buy a house in Guernsey. Bruce Heimbeck says that's what inspired the group to take action.
We decided going in that we weren't going to make money, but we're going to use our money to try and at least make a little bit of a difference.
So over the last few years, the two brothers and four of their peers have met on a regular basis in the back room of Wyoming West Realty to tackle that problem. They call themselves Growing Guernsey, or G2. This was their idea. The six of them would approach the bank and ask for a line of credit. Each would offer $20,000, either in land they owned or the cash itself as collateral.
It was definitely an interesting first discussion.
That's Dan Sisson. He's the president at First State Bank in Guernsey.
You know, obviously if you're in business, usually you're looking to make money, but they were more concerned with helping clean up some areas in town and have some new housing for people.
Sisson says the bank approved a line of credit for $120,000, and G2 used it first to buy an old apartment building at auction. G2 member Bruce Heimbeck says the building was cheap because it was basically stripped down to the studs.
We turned around and sold that at our cost to a local contractor who then completely finished it off, and it's now has 10 apartments.
10 rental apartments that are now affordable housing in the community. The group then turned their attention to building a house from scratch. Heimbeck says first they had to find the right lot to build on.
Because lot costs are, you know, they're a major factor in your housing, and you can't do affordable housing if you don't have an affordable lot.
Finding an affordable lot was one challenge. Chuck Frederick says finding one that the owner was willing to sell was another.
We still have a lot of vacant lots, but some people are not willing to release them, sell them. Some of them are, no, I'm going to give it to my son or daughter, or we're going to keep it in the family.
Eventually, success. They found a lot, hired contractors, and built their first house.
Three bedrooms, two baths, and a two-car garage. And we sold that first home then. Not a fancy home, but we sold it for about $135,000.
And it was just what Mark and Heather Wilson were looking for.
We had looked at several houses in the area.
But what they had wanted was out of their price range. But then they saw the house G2 built.
And then this was brand new. And the price of that was huge. So that was like the deciding factor.
G2 built two more houses and even fixed up a property downtown that now hosts three different businesses. But the last house they built stayed on the market for a while, and then they had trouble finding another lot to buy. Chuck Frederick says it appeared that the market was changing and fewer people were looking to buy houses. They needed something else.
Rental homes are certainly needed in the town. There's very few places to rent.
He says at that point, they decided G2 had run its course. They paid back their loan and pretty much broke even. Now they hope some younger people in the community will pick up the baton. Dan Sisson at First State Bank says he's not sure that will happen anytime soon.
To be honest with you, I think it took a special group of people to come together that, like I said, were willing to, you know, take some risk.
He says he's not holding his breath. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
As a small, rural state, Wyoming is not a huge player in commercial air service, but many want to change that. Currently, a bill working its way through the legislature proposes a new subsidy program that could create more reliable air service. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska takes a look at what the new approach entails and what one community thinks about it.
Cade Mastis is a co-founder of an outdoor equipment company in Lander. Not the most convenient location for an international company since Lander isn't close to any interstate and the closest airport, Riverton Regional Airport, hasn't always been reliable.
We traveled to Jackson or to Casper, which added, you know, we'd usually have to go over the night before to get an early morning flight. And so we were spending extra nights away from our family. And then we were also booking hotels that were costing us money that we couldn't put back into the company.
In 2014, the Riverton Regional Airport saw a 41% decrease in the number of enplanements. That counts the number of people that boarded the plane in Riverton. Kyle Butterfield, the manager of the airport, says people were frustrated because planes don't fly in and out on time. He blames changes in the air service industry.
There were some changes to pilot hour requirements and crew rest requirements, and we saw a significant impact on the ability for Great Lakes to provide service in our communities.
Those industry changes also drove up ticket prices. However, Riverton was able to obtain a contract with Denver Air Connection, a private air charter company, which is slowly getting customers back.
They're going back to their local airport. They're reminded of how nice it is to only have to drive 10 minutes to your commercial airport instead of potentially 2 hours or 6 hours or 7 hours.
Riverton was only able to obtain this service with the state's help. Amy Surdam with the Aeronautic Division for Wyoming says in 2004, the state introduced the Air Service Enhancement Program, or ASEP. The program contributes funds to the community to match the minimum guarantee revenue demanded by an airline. Surdam says the program helped, but they think there's a better way to go about things.
What if we just came together, the communities and the state, and tried to purchase capacity on aircraft, and then we would have more say in gate time, in local fare ticket pricing possibly, and in how we market this.
The legislature is considering a bill which creates a working group to be in place for 1 year to finalize a 10-year capacity purchase contract with a single airline for the entire state. Senator Michael Von Fladern, who introduced the bill, says it's a win-win for both the state and the airline carrier.
But if they don't fill the seats or don't get enough on board, they actually will fly that at a loss, where this one guarantees them. In return, we're asking for them to guarantee us 10 years of service.
Jeremiah Riemann of Endow says ASEP has used over $60 million since its inception in 2004, and the proposed program only requires $15 million for all 10 years.
Under conservative estimates, that within a 3 to 5 year time frame, that the model can be self-sustaining no longer require any state assistance and ultimately perhaps return funding back to local communities for expanded air service to other destinations.
Amy Surdam says the main reason the proposal needs to pass is because ASEP will run out of resources by July 1st of next year, and it doesn't look like the legislature will give it any more money.
If we don't do this, then you're looking at disrupting service potentially in Riverton, Rock Springs, or Sheridan, or those communities would have to come up with the full minimal revenue guarantees themselves.
While many are excited about the proposal, Lander businessman Cade Mastis is skeptical.
Airlines don't know what they're doing 6 months from now, so getting a 10-year commitment seems not based in reality.
For now, it's up to the legislature to pass the proposal and then see whether a carrier would actually sign a 10-year contract. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kudelska from the Center for the West in Cody.
Energy is always an issue in the Wyoming legislature, but this year the conversation revolves around money. 13 bills arose related to energy, with only 4 still moving through the system. If passed, the bills would impact wind development, oil and gas producers, and more. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports.
Inside the crowded Jonah Building, legislators walk amongst lobbyists, journalists, and large groups of kids on field trips. The full Senate is about to meet, discuss issues including education, gun rights, and energy. Senate President Eli Bebout starts it off.
Well, the last day for third reading on bills in the House of Origin, so if
It's the third of 4 weeks in this year's budget session. The current revenue crunch, many bills have revolved around spurring new revenue, finding new sources, or cutting back on spending. For energy, the bills still surviving, unsurprisingly, also come down to money. One that incentivizes new wind development, another new oil and gas development, and the last, making sure counties get the tax money they're owed. Four bills came up around wind this year, but the one still surviving is about making Wyoming more attractive to new development. Lander Senator Cale Case has pushed for several bills that would build a framework supporting wind development. He says the state needs to talk about it.
People are just beginning to understand the ramifications of gigantic wind farms in our landscape.
With the bill dying that pushed for a hike in the production tax, the surviving piece of legislation around wind is House Bill 152. It would give wind companies a property tax exemption if they store equipment here. Case says right now, many wind companies operating in Wyoming are leaving their equipment elsewhere.
They're coming to Wyoming whether we pass this property tax break or not, but this would allow us to get something for them and encourage that industry here.
Companies would need to pay Wyoming sales tax to receive the exemption. The next energy bill still on the table is House Bill 72. It would protect counties from a systematic issue where mineral companies aren't paying ad valorem taxes, a one-time tax paid when minerals are severed from the ground. This bill would help counties avoid legal recourse if they aren't able to fully collect those taxes. Gillette Senator Michael Von Fladern says it's a step in the right direction.
That was only one part of it. The real root of that problem is the ad valorem monthly collections. We don't. Now, right now, you can wait even 18 months before you pay your ad valorem tax.
According to a report from the Powder River Basin Resource Council, Wyoming counties are missing out on over $42 million in ad valorem taxes from 2006 to 2016. That money is big in financing both the local and state school systems, in addition to county services. Von Fladern says he hopes to see another study on mineral tax delinquency in the interim session this summer. One bill in particular, though, has attracted a lot of attention this session.
The severance tax could be a big one.
The most important one is the severance tax, SF 98.
Senate File 92 has passed the Senate. Senate File 98, third reading of the Senate file.
Senate File 98. It would cut severance taxes in half for oil and gas companies after the second year of production until the end of the fourth. Senate President Eli Bebout is a sponsor. He says Wyoming taxes energy too harshly and that this bill could help attract new oil and gas development.
Wyoming has a very, very difficult time competing with our states of the South and other plays in this country.
He adds a severance tax exemption could be an incentive to win over companies deciding where to locate. But many disagree, primarily because there's been no recent analysis about whether the exemption would actually spur development. Professor of Economics at the University of Wyoming, Chuck Mason, explains.
And it matters a lot whether or not the tax reduction has a minor effect or a large effect. If it has a minor effect, you're giving money away. If it has a large effect, you're probably increasing your revenues. And so that's kind of the debate.
Mason says tax revenue is also relatively small by the time this exemption would kick in. He says he has a difficult time imagining how the discount could result in a big increase in tax collections.
You know, you'd have to have a pretty meaningful reduction in costs, I think, in order to tilt the scales.
In the year 2000, a University of Wyoming report did analyze the impact of changes to severance taxes due to a similar bill that arose back then. It said that small changes in severance tax would not directly stimulate drilling. Several advocacy groups have pointed to the report and voicing their opposition to the bill. Powder River Basin Resource Council's Casey Quinn.
We've been really fighting this bill because time and time again, there's no data to support that lowering severance taxes benefits the state's economy.
And Senator Cale Case says the bill carries the thumbprint of Senate leadership, and that helps a lot in moving it forward.
The trouble is it's not going to make any money for Wyoming. We're going to lose money on this bill. And it's just a time we shouldn't be losing money.
Then comes the vote.
Chief Clerk, please call the roll.
Agar? Aye. Anderson? Aye. Anselmi Dalton? No. Baldwin? Vote closed. Senate File 98, 17 aye, 13 no.
With the affirmative vote, SF 98 has since been introduced into the House. The other energy bills touching on ad valorem tax protections, critical infrastructure, and wind equipment property taxes have also moved forward for review. The legislature will decide the fate of these bills and others in the next week. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
When we come back, we'll talk with a Casper author about sexual assault reporting. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. What would you do if your best friend were sexually assaulted? That's the question Casper author Kiersey Burkhart tackles in her new young adult novel, Honor Code, where an allegation of sexual assault rocks Edwards Academy, a prestigious private high school on the East Coast. Burkhart and I discussed the book and its message at her home in Casper, and she told me that up until recently, she'd been writing middle grade books about horses.
I had just published my series of horse books. Mostly it's about friendship and finding yourself. So my editor's boss had read some of my horse books and came to my agent and said, I want a book about the subject of the explosion of rape reports on private campuses. And I want it to be a character-driven story, and I think Kiersey would be perfect for it, which is a little out of nowhere. But it totally is in my wheelhouse, and so that was the only directive. I started reading everything I could find about the subject of private schools and the cross sections of sexual assault and privilege and power, and that's where Honor Code was born.
I see traces of the article in Rolling Stone on the alleged rape on the UVA campus, at Columbia where a student carried around her mattress in protest. How did you go about researching to shape the story in Honor Code?
I worked a lot with a victim advocate from a university. I had an idea for a story that I'd put together and a really, really rough first draft of the book. And she presented so many fantastic criticisms and issues to tackle in the book that really shaped what it would eventually become.
This book is coming out at an interesting moment with the Me Too movement sort of in full swing. Where do you see Honor Code fitting into the current conversation?
It's really fascinating that that happened because we finished all final edits on this book in May of last year, and then the Me Too movement really gained momentum in October. One of the things I hope that teens can take away from Honor Code is that privilege and power asymmetry manifests in a lot of different ways. So we saw it even back in the era of women coming forward about Bill Cosby, that why didn't you come forward sooner? And what I really hope people take away from Honor Code is that every story is a part of the fabric of rape culture, and that we're trying to draw arbitrary lines in the sand between who has the right to speak and tell their story and who doesn't. And it's important that we respect each victim's willingness or unwillingness to tell their story.
We're going to talk a little bit about the ending now. So spoiler alert, if you're listening, not all of the characters have been exactly truthful in this book. The main character, Sam, basically co-opting another girl's story on a quest for justice to take down these perpetrators. Are you expecting any pushback about that twist?
I have seen a couple bubbles already about that. I really want the ending to show the intricacies of the problem and how it locks us all into a box where justice isn't being served.
I have to ask as a follow-up question, is it responsible as an author to have this twist at the end, to have an unreliable narrator when data shows the vast majority of reported sexual assaults are real?
Those in positions of legal power, judges, police, believe that 50% of rape victims aren't telling the truth. That is a really staggering number. Just like let that sink in for a moment, that most of the people who are responsible, who are a part of the system, believe that at least half of victims are lying. I think it would be irresponsible not to engage with that in some way or another. Why Gracie can't speak for herself, why Gracie doesn't feel comfortable coming forward, and then someone else saying, well, I don't agree with your choice about how you want to tell your story. We see that happen a lot.
Gracie is, of course, the actual girl who was raped in the story and decides not to come forward, who has her story co-opted. The book does raise questions of ownership of a narrative. What do you think it reveals about privilege and storytelling?
Stories are how we build empathy. Stories are how we explore difficult subjects, and especially books for children and teens provide readers kind of a safe space to explore really difficult issues. I almost call it like an emotional training ground. I would hope that the message at the end of the book is that what Sam did was wrong, and that she faces that from Gracie, whose story she took. I hope that the takeaway is each person owns their own story.
Kiersey Burkhart is the author of the new book, Honor Code. It's out everywhere this weekend. Kiersey, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Wyoming Governor Matt Mead was in Washington for the National Governors Association meeting, and the nation's opioid crisis was a central focus. Washington correspondent Matt Laszlo caught up with him and has this story.
The nation is now annually witnessing as many deaths from opioids and heroin as were lost during the entire Vietnam War. Governor Mead says policymakers have to think more broadly about the crisis.
You know, there's cause and effect in when you look at substance abuse because, you know, I started my life as a prosecutor in Gillette, and cocaine was the issue, and then crack was the issue, and then meth, and then crystal meth. And so I think it is really important that we look at opioid abuse because it's a little different because, quote, it's legal and a doctor gave it to me. But as we're looking at that, we can't forget the overall macro view that we have to have if substance abuse remains a problem.
Mead is a states' rights conservative, but he says this crisis is an issue where states like Wyoming need strong federal assistance, especially when it comes to the importation of deadly substances like fentanyl that's coming in from China and Mexico before being laced in drugs like heroin.
We need to clamp down on this, but we have to watch it in every other area because it is a bit of a whack-a-mole situation. You hit on one area and heroin then pops up. So it's something that we have to look at very broadly. It's not just an opioid problem. It's a substance abuse problem within our state and our country.
Dealing with this crisis could strain Wyoming's budget. So Mead says states need more federal assistance from everything from first responders to local health centers.
You know, I think it is important. I mean, not just Wyoming, but all states get money for health programs from the federal government. And I think our hope is the federal government is responsive to this as I think the state should be.
Mead says it was good to hear from other governors on what they're doing on the ground because he wants to help stem the tide of addiction which is gripping many families.
You know, and it's, again, it's not just about the individual. It's the cost to our society when people are not able to function properly because they have an addiction problem. And so I had a great hearing what other states were doing yesterday. You know, I think there's opportunity for improvement in Wyoming and all states, and so we're going to keep after it.
While Mead says the White House is stepping up its efforts, other governors are more critical. North Carolina Democratic Governor Roy Cooper served on the president's opioid commission and says more is needed.
I've been concerned about it, and they have not moved fast enough.
Cooper says federal policymakers are forgetting a key part of the issue.
The big issue here is one they have not addressed, and that's medical coverage for everyone. I mean, quality health care coverage for everyone would do more than anything to address the opioid problem because we'd have quality treatment for everyone. And that is the main key right now.
But the administration continues to try to gut Obamacare, and Republicans in Congress repealed the Affordable Care Act's health insurance mandate. And for Republicans like Wyoming Senator John Barrasso, repealing Obamacare remains a goal, and they say it's a separate issue from the opioid crisis.
Education, funding, involvement of the medical community, involvement with the patient community, the mental health community, all of those are important.
Barrasso is a doctor, and he says a part of what's needed is better training for the medical community.
The opioid crisis continues to be
very significant nationwide, but certainly in Wyoming as well. I met with a number of physicians today, as well as last week in the state of Wyoming. Clearly, doctors are now realizing just how addictive these substances are that I don't think doctors recognized early on as they were prescribing. So there's a whole new attention to prescribing as well as treatment.
Congress has to pass a government funding bill by the end of March, and health advocates are fighting to get billions of dollars more directed to combating the epidemic. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. If you'd like to hear the entire program or individual segments, go to our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Anna Rader is our web editor.
If you have good story ideas, you can submit those through our Facebook page or our website. And if you haven't liked our page yet, be sure to do that while you're there, too.
Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.